Thanks a lot. Good morning. My name is Scott Lee, and I am an alcoholic, and very, very grateful to be here. I thought we might open with a little bit of play, because my wife says that that laughter is the sound effect of recovery, and I believe that. And anyway, on page 31 in the text, we're going to do this together. We're going to do a showing of hands. Despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe they're in that class. By every form of self-deception and experimentation, they'll try to prove themselves the exceptions to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic. If anyone who is showing inability to control his drinking can do the right about face, drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to him. Heaven knows we have tried hard enough and long enough to drink like other people. Here are some, not all, some of the methods we have tried. Drinking beer only. Who tried the beer experiment? I'm not drinking the hard stuff. I ain't smoking none of that either.
Wet beds.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Limiting the number of drinks. Only going to have two. That was the worst one, I thought. Never drinking alone. Try that. Never drinking in the morning. Now, hold on. Just a technicality. A Brandy Alexander is actually just being continental. Right? That's not really drinking. Yes, that's drinking. Okay. We have to call it by its own name. Drinking only at home. I sponsor a cop in Nashville, and he said he approached the scene of a one-car wreck. The car's like around a phone pole. By the time he gets past the trunk, he can smell the booze. He gets to the front. The window's down. The guy's laying there. Ron leans in and says, "Are you okay?" Guy says, "You know what, officer? I've absolutely got to stop driving." That made sense to you, didn't it? Never having it in the house. Did you ever pour it out? Did they ever pour it out?
No.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Never drinking during business hours. Now, technically, lunch is not business hours. And a friend of mine says, anytime I'm defending myself with a technicality, I'm already wrong. Yeah, he did that. Drinking only at parties. Well, I'm a party hunting a location, aren't you? I'm a mobile. Switching from scotch to brandy. Try to move to something you didn't like so you wouldn't drink too much of it? Yes, sir. Drinking only natural wines. No, that ripple was never anywhere near a grape. No, we're not counting. You know, the problem with the wines is when you puke, it's stringy. You just always got to wipe. Have you seen the ads on TV for this new Budweiser beer, Budweiser Select? And one of the things they say about it is finish is clean. You've seen that? I know what that means. That means you put it right where you want it when you puke, and you don't even have to wipe. So when you see that commercial, you'll know. Finish is clean, right? Agreeing to resign if ever drunk on the job. Anybody ever get trapped on the job? Taking a trip, not taking a trip. Don't you love that? Swearing off forever. Who quit forever? Who quit forever solemn oath on the Bible in front of witnesses at least once? All right, that's pretty good. Who peed in the closet? Did you really? I never did that. I'm so embarrassed for you. I don't believe I'd have told that. There's a big difference between a fist step and sharing in a meeting. I don't believe I would have told. I will admit my first wife's still mad about that antique coffee table we used to have in the living room. I will give you that. Who's taking meetings into jails and prisons? Keep them up for a minute. Anybody else, if you're suffering from depression, get with one of these people and take one meeting into the joint. Just one. It will break a depression faster than anything else I've ever seen, and it won't have a negative impact on your recovery. It's an amazing process. Taking more physical exercise. You ever try that? I was playing tennis stoned one time. Let me tell you something. Running and laughing are a bad combination. You can get hurt doing that. Reading inspirational books. Who's got everything Og Mandino ever wrote? Yes, sir. There we are. We're the ones that buy all of that stuff, right? Going to health farms and sanitariums. Where do you think you are? Accepting voluntary commitment to asylums. That was actually captured and put in the asylum. I didn't volunteer. We can increase the list ad infinitum. It's Latin. It means forever. I thought it was kind of an interesting point. Page 60. We talked last night about a God concept, this idea of let's choose one and what those characteristics might be. So A, he convinces me he's alcoholic and can't manage his own life. B, no human power could have relieved his alcoholism. None did in the past, none can in the future. And before I go to C, I want to establish a God concept that can work. And I think that was so important to do that piece. And it says, there's an interesting thing actually at the top of page 57. It says, save for a few brief moments of temptation, the thought of drink has never returned, and at such times a great revulsion has risen up in him. I'll tell you what, that's a sane reaction for a guy with my kind of history. You know, I say I don't see where it promises me manageability, but it sure promises me sanity. And this is one of them. It says seemingly he could not drink, even if he would, God had restored his sanity. Sanity of action. Sanity of action. What is this but a miracle of healing? Its elements are simple. Circumstances made him willing to believe. In a case like mine, it means he worked himself into a crack he could not lie his way out of. Right? Circumstances made him willing to believe. He humbly offered himself to his maker. Then he knew. It doesn't say he said, you know, get me out of this and I'll never do it again. Or, God, do all of this and I'll, you know, some of you are old enough to remember it, praying to the great Monty Hall in the sky. You know, let's make a deal. Remember that show? Let's make a deal. Yeah, I was always trying to do that. But he didn't ask for help here. He didn't say, give me some help. He said, take me. Carte blanche means white paper. When I give somebody carte blanche, it means I signed the bottom blank and hand it to you and you fill it in any way you want to. That's what this is. Take me. Then he knew. Even so, as God restored us all to our right minds, to this man the revelation was sudden. Some of us grow into more slowly. Here's one of the most powerful promises in the book, I think. But he has come to all who have honestly sought him. When we drew near to him, he disclosed himself to us. A friend of mine says that the analogy is God's a little bit like the mother of a three-year-old playing hide-and-seek with her child. Where does she hide? She hides where the child can find her. All that child must do is seek. This is my heavenly parent, and I don't have to find him. I just have to seek. Page 60, see that God could and would if he were sought. Well, this God we talked about, we said was all-powerful, so I say he could. And would, well, let's see. He loves me. He's gentle. He's eager to forgive. He has a sense of humor. He wants what's best for me. I'd say he would. And if he were sought, not found. Yeah, item one, God is not lost, does not require to be found, but simply sought. And I wish, just for myself, when we read this portion in the meetings, we'd pick up this next phrase. It says, being convinced we are at step three. Convinced of what? A, B, and C. Are you convinced of A, B, and C? Welcome to step three. Which is that we decided to turn our will and life over to God, as we understand. It doesn't say over to the care of God, it says over to God. In the short form of the step, it says over to the care of God. And I don't have an editorial on that, but I do observe it. But I do observe what my sponsor told me, that step three is clearly not where we turn our will and lives over to God or over to the care of God. If we could do that at step three, we would have a three-step program. What could be left after that? This is where we decide to do that. I learned this from Bob. The word decide comes from the Latin verb scissore, which means to cut. It's the same root word as the word for scissors or incision. A decision, I cut away the other options and act upon the one I have decided. That's what the word means. So step three is where I decide to turn my will and life over to the care of God or over to God. Pick one. And I think the question then becomes, how do I do that? And I believe the answers are numbered 4 through 12. Short form. Having had a spiritual awakening sounds a lot like well in life over to God. Spiritual awakening, in my experience, is a process. And it's there was a moment this morning when I was asleep, and there was the next moment I was awake. But a few seconds later, I was more awake. And when Linda and I finished our morning prayers, I was more awake. When I stepped out of the shower, I was more awake. I'm more awake now than I was when I got out of the shower. I think this spiritual awakening thing continues to be that way, that there's not an end to it. It's not a yes or no question. It's a process that if I stay involved in this, doesn't end. And that's one of the most exciting parts about it. I was sober less than a year, and I heard a speaker who was sober 22 years. No, he was sober 20, talk about he and his sponsor lived in different cities at this point, and they hadn't been together in about a year. His sponsor had 22, and they had spent their first 2 hours together talking about all the new stuff they'd learned and all the growth they'd had since the last time they'd been together. I thought, wow. So there's not an end to that. Continuing on page 60, just what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? The first requirement, aha, there are requirements. And if there's a first, there must be more than one. First requirement is we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. Have you ever seen one? I never have. I've seen a lot of lives run on self-will. I've seen them that were financially successful. I've seen some people I would love to trade wallets with, but I wouldn't trade hearts. Because I've seen them with a lot of money that don't smile. I have not seen a life run on self-will that looked like a complete success to me. Have you? This is a question I'm saying again. This is how I present this to a new guy in recovery. And new guy is someone I'm sponsoring for the first time, even if he's got more time than I do. He's still new to me. And this is how I present it. says, on that basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Collision! Bam! Bent metal, broken glass, blood, screaming. That's collision. That's different from, like, mild disagreement on rare occasion. Collision! And then it says, astoundingly enough, even though our motives are good. I've been hearing people in meetings for 24 years say, check your motives. And here it says very clearly, that won't work. I hear a lot of popular stuff in the fellowship that seems to be in direct conflict with what the text says. It does tell me in two places to check my motives. It says if I'm going to bed with somebody, is my motive selfish? It says when I'm going where they serve booze, do I really have a good reason to be? It's the only place it tells me to check my motive. Everywhere else it tells me principle. This is my perspective on that. Is that when I operate from motive, I'm actually playing God. It's one of the ways I play God. Because with motive, I'm making it come out the way I think it should come out. And that's playing God. When I operate from principle, I'm doing what I think God wants me to do, irrespective of result. That's how I turn it over to Him, as I use His means. It's that simple. And I got this lesson. I'm a commission salesman. I call on major accounts. That's what I do for a living. I had a customer at a major account who was, he was putting a lot of money in my pocket, and he could have tripled that by adding items. We were close personal friends. This guy was a Lutheran. I still don't know what that means. We did, because we had spiritual discussions like I had with you guys, but not a religious one. So I really don't know much about that religion, but I know about his spirituality, and he knew about mine. Our wives were friends. We're guests in each other's home. I am close to this guy. I get a phone call from him, and he says, my wife's just given birth. It's 2 months early. And the news from the hospital is not good. He says, would you come down here and pray over this child? I said, you bet I would. I got my car and I drove to Vanderbilt Hospital. I remember pulling into the parking lot, doing what I've been told, checking my motives, right? And I can't answer the question. I can't tell me, honestly. Am I going down there to pray over this child to bring spiritual relief to this family? Or am I going down there to pray over this child to look good to the old man so he'll put another couple of $100,000 a year in my pocket? I cannot answer the question. And I believe this. When I can't get an answer, one of two things is in place. I've either asked the wrong question, and the right question on the wrong day is still the wrong question. Or it's okay that I make a mistake here, because all of my lessons can't be learned without mistakes. See, I'm not supposed to be perfect. I'm supposed to make mistakes. It's my assignment. We'll talk about that when we get into step four. And sometimes I have to make a mistake and live with the results so that I can learn. And I volunteered. I gave God the carte blanche. I prayed the third step prayer and I meant it. And that means I've also volunteered to make mistakes and go through things so maybe somebody else can watch it who couldn't have gone through it so that they can get a lesson. You see, I signed on for that too. And I don't know. And so I sit there in that car and I don't have any time. I know it's the right question. It's the right day. I need to know right now. And I said, Father, I need some help here, please. I'm not going to ask you to believe this came from God. I want you to know that I believe it. And the next thing that came into my mind was a very clear question. And the question was, does going into a hospital to pray over a sick child violate any of your principles? And the answer was no. Then go ahead and do it, because there are no wrong reasons for doing the right thing. There are no wrong reasons for doing the right thing. There are likewise no right reasons for doing the wrong thing. Page 42. Last two lines. Quite as important was the discovery that spiritual principles would solve all my problems. I got to get out of the motive business. It gets me nothing but trouble. Page 60. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to have good motives in all our affairs. Not what it says. And motive and principle are frequently opposed. I have got to get out of the motive business because it makes me crazy. I operate from principle is how I do it his way. I'm blue collar. I'm not in management anymore. I'm not responsible for the result. I'm responsible for my own action. It was a huge lesson for me. Maybe one more example, and I'm going to turn this over to Bob for a few minutes. Interesting story. These two married people were in good shape financially. They both had great jobs. They had plenty of vacation time. Their kids both played in the high school band. They had band practice that afternoon and a safe ride home. And they decided to spend an afternoon in a motel because it felt to them like they had lost the spark from the early part of their relationship, and they thought they might regain it that way. Yeah, which everybody says, pretty good motive. We got to be in good shape with this, right? Did I leave out the detail that they're not married to each other? Did I miss that part? Yeah, details. I am capable of that kind of thinking, if I go with motive. A fellow I used to sponsor, we were sitting in a meeting one time, and there was a new girl in town who had, in our meeting, she said, "I've just moved here from wherever." Gorgeous young lady. And he leans over to me, he says, "I think I'm going to get a map of the city and mark some of the better meetings for her and give it to her after the meeting, you know, try to help her get started well in Nashville AA." And I said, "Well, I think that's a really good motive, but I noticed there's a guy that just moved here too. Why don't you give it to him?" And his face just fell. I got to make sure I'm not giving the map to the new girl. That gets me nothing but trouble. So I do so much better when I operate from principle rather than motive. It's one of the reasons I need a sponsor to help me differentiate. Bob?
Thank you, Scott. Good morning. I'm Bob Darrell. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Bob.
The 12 by 12, it says the effectiveness of the whole AA program rests on what we're talking about this morning, this ability to, or commitment to, or being convinced that we must make this decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. In 1978, in my first couple months of sobriety, I was at a meeting. And I was at a meeting, and I shared something at the meeting that got this old timer's attention. He cornered me after the meeting, and he said to me, he says, "Bob," he says, you got to take step three." And I'm looking at the wall where they have the 12 steps, and I'm reading the step, and I said to this guy, Joe, I said, "Joe, I can't take step three." And he said, "Why not?" I said, "Because I don't really know if there's a God or not." He said, "You don't have to believe in God to take step three." I said, "Joe, it says we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. I not only don't I understand God, I don't even know if there is one." He said, "You don't have to believe in God to take step three." I said, I don't get it. He says, "Listen, kid," he says, "I'll make you a promise. If you'll turn your will and your life over to this chair," and he points to a chair in the meeting room, he says, "I guarantee you an instant miracle." So I said, "Okay, I turn my will and my life over the chair. What's the miracle?" He says, "Oh, the miracle would be your life's no longer in the hands of an idiot." When he said that, I didn't even get my feelings hurt. I just thought, yeah, that'd be right. Because if you'd have followed me around and observed me the last couple years, as maybe your family or loved ones or coworkers have observed you, if they could really see what was going on with you, whoever watched you would easily come to the decision and the conclusion that whoever's making decisions for this person is out to destroy them. And yet, inside of me, my ego defends everything I've ever done, no matter how self-destructive. I can't see it. In 1978, after 7 years of relapsing, when he said that to me, there was no defense. I didn't defend myself. My ego had been pushed out of me just enough that I was able to go, yeah, that'd be right. That'd be right. I think to move closer to God is not to move closer to God so much as to move away from me. Right? And this whole thing is moving. It's my friend Sandy says, his sponsor told him, he says, "Why don't you just turn your will and your life over to whatever will take it?" You know, just like.
There's no prize.
Right, there's no right. I mean, if you can find something to take it, you've lucked out, man. I mean, because when you think about it, if you look at your life objectively, if you stand back from it, I mean, the problem I face, and the book says the alcoholic's problem lies mainly in his mind. Well, when I'm afraid, when I'm frustrated, when I'm at conflict with life, I don't know about you guys, what's the first thing you do? It's probably the first thing I do. Think. I turn towards the source of the problem, trying to get an answer, right? Einstein said one time that a mind that creates a problem cannot solve it. And I am the source of all my problems. And I was very lucky to have gotten just enough of me kicked out of me that I could I didn't defend myself when people in AA said something. I was the defender, the explainer, the justifier, and the rationalizer. And I was able to stand there and when he said that and just go, yeah, you're right. I've had two problems with step three, minor problems, step one and step two. Basically, when you got step one and step two, step three is automatic. There's nowhere else to go. There is nowhere else to go. You'll turn your will and your life over to a chair, anything, because you're stuck. And you can't fix it. Nobody else can fix it. You've tried everything on the horizon, and here you are. There's nowhere else to go. I think sometimes the ABCs, if you got A, I think A plus B equals C sometimes. If I really get that I was alcoholic and I could not manage my own life, and I am, as the book says, convinced, being convinced, if I'm convinced of that, and I'm convinced that no human power, if I got both of those things, what's left? Maybe there better be something that could, and I better seek it, whatever it is. There's nowhere else to go. One of my favorite authors, he says that, I encourage the guys I sponsor, what's to think about, how does a surrendered person act? Get a vision of that. Because there are going to be times when your head's attacking, you got to act like that guy, not you. Right? How does a surrendered person conduct himself in life? How would I respond to this scary situation if I really knew that I was in the hands of God? How would I respond? One of my favorite authors says that I travel a lot. You know, when you travel a lot, it's like I think the airlines create forced surrenders periodically. I mean, you don't have much choice, right? And Kurt Vonnegut, one of his books said, he said that unusual last-minute drastic changes in travel plans are dancing lessons from God. Am I able to go with the flow? I can measure my distance from my surrender sometimes by how willing I am to turn, change me to fit the things that are occurring that aren't my idea and I don't like. I can measure. If I'm the guy who's angst over that, well, that's a measure of my distance from God and my distance from my own surrender. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with this. In our book, it talks about our spiritual kit of tools that have been laid in our feet, and it's laid at our feet because I got one. My toolkit has two tools, a hammer and a crowbar. Right? That's all I got. And it's maybe some duct tape if you'll sit still. I mean, that's about all I got. And I've had to pick up some different things. It's funny how in 1978, my abstinence was so much less painful than every time I got sober before. And what I've discovered is that pain does not come from change. It comes from my resistance to change. That's what pulls at me and hurts me. Life is moving, the flow of life and God's will is moving me in one direction and I'm trying to go the other. That's very, very painful. Page 62, one of the most, and to me was one of the most crucial paragraphs. My sponsor got on a kick for a long time in my early sobriety where it seemed like whatever I asked him, he would say, well, just go read page 60 through 63. And now what I learned over the years is I have the guys I sponsored take a pencil and go through that part of the book and cross out all the plural pronouns and put it a first-person pronoun. So in other words, in the ABCs, it says we were alcoholic. No, I was alcoholic and could not manage my own life. And I haven't changed it to first-person. because when I first started reading this, it's all in the third person. So it's like about you, right? And I could see it was about you. I could see there were people in AA that were self-centered and they were trying to run the whole show. I mean, I could really see that very clearly. I figured my sponsor wanted me to read this so I'd know so I could straighten you out. And it's funny, there's a line in the 12x12 that says that we will be quick to see our defects in others and slow to see them in ourselves. And one day, some magic happened in my life, and sometimes spiritual magic happens when spiritual principles meet spiritual pain. I was having one of those kind of days where I was just, I was getting crazier and crazier by the minute. One of those kind of crazy days where there's nothing really big going on to justify the angst that's occurring inside of me. But it's one of those days where I go to work and the customers are just kind of annoying. You know what I mean? They're all very self-centered. They all want a lot of attention. You know what I mean? And my boss he doesn't understand all the things I do for him. I'm not really appreciated. I can see him, he's taking advantage of me. I'm working harder than all the other employees there. And as the day goes on, every little interaction with someone is like a tightening of a spring in the pit of my stomach. A little tighter. I get off work and I'm secretary in a meeting that night. And I have to stop by the grocery store to get some styrofoam cups for the meeting. I'm in a hurry. I'm meeting a new guy at the meeting, so I'm kind of on a mission from God. And I go to the grocery store. I get the styrofoam cup packet. I get in the 13-item or less line, that express line, and there's a woman in front of me with 15 items. I counted them twice. The second time I'm counting them, I'm pointing at each item, right? Now I want to choke her, but here's what I really want to do. I really want to go back in the office. I want to get the manager. I want to pull him out here. I want to make him count the items and then point at the sign, right? That's what I really – but I'm in a hurry, and this will all just slow me down, and I just like – it's like the spring, tighter and tighter. I get out of there. I get in traffic. I get behind a woman who is driving 5 miles an hour below the speed limit. My head is going to explode. I have thoughts of flooring it, slamming into her. We're both die, but she'll realize, right? I mean, you know, I'm insane. I get to the meeting. My new guy's there. He's there waiting for me. I tell him where to sit. I get the literature all laid out. I wait for the perfect two guys to come in to chair this meeting to give my guy the message of hope he needs. I tell the one guy, I say, listen, we're not going to read chapter 5. Got a new guy here, we're going to read chapter 3. And, you know, people in AA, are just, when you're a nutcase, they just shrug their shoulders and go, yeah, whatever, you know, right? So I'm laying this out. I could picture this guy getting a year mentioning my name. The meeting starts, and they read chapter 3, and the chairperson says, does anybody have anything they want to share? And some guy, evidently just out of treatment, raises his hand, and he starts talking about shooting heroin. Another guy in the meeting cuts him off and says, you can't talk about that. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. Somebody else jumps in and says, hey, wait a minute. He can talk about anything he wants to talk about. And it's instantly the meeting from hell. You know what I mean? It's horrible. And I'm sitting there and I'm fuming after all I've done. Right? No one's ever done so much for so many, so often for so little. And I am like, I'm ready to quit Alcoholics Anonymous because I'm the only one here that really sees the spiritual truth here. Right? And I get the meetings over, I throw the literature in the bag and storm out of the meeting, and I go home, and like Pavlov's dog, I call my sponsor because I've been trained to do that. My sponsor says, read page 60 through 63. And listen to what I found. The bottom is page 60. He says, I'm like the actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the traffic, the people in the grocery store, the customers, the other employees, the people sharing in AA in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including myself, would be pleased and life would be wonderful. And for the first time in my life, I saw it was me. And I got to tell you something. Until I could put that on and wear it, Alcoholics Anonymous is just information. It's just academic. It never gets into here. There's a place in step one where it talks about where this program happens. And it says, it starts out with step one saying, we learned we had to fully concede, not intellectually, to our innermost self. That's why Alcoholics Anonymous in the 12 steps is not an academic process. It's an experiential process. It has to happen in here. And we all know people who could memorize the book, who could tell, who could put on a fantastic step workshops. They got it up here, but they don't get it down here. And what happens? Well, the ego, if you're like me, the ego chooses its weapons wisely. And the ego will take the big book. It'll take spiritual principles. It'll take the traditions. And it'll use them to feel smugly superior and to be in control. The ego doesn't care what it uses. And people that do that, they don't know that they're doing that because they know that they can back it up. They can show you page numbers. But aren't they really separating themselves from others? Ego cares about its own self-grandizement, and that's it. And this part of the book really starts to talk about the enemy. Because if I'm going to know what I'm moving towards, I need to know what I'm moving away from. What has been running my life? I remember Chuck Chamberlain one time. It was unbelievable. He stood at the podium in the middle of his talk, and he looked out at the audience, and he's rubbing his hands together, and he's looking everybody in the eyes. He took about 3 minutes to do this. He says, what controls you? And he looked at somebody else. He says, what controls you? And when he looked at me, I got chills. I knew something was driving me. I just didn't know what it was. Because I felt like something had been driving me all my life. What driver am I trying to get away from? I know where I'm supposed to go. I'm supposed to go towards God. But I think the same thing is true in the realm of the spirit. That's true in the realm of the fellowship. In order to stay in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've had to learn the roads out of AA. I know what it looks like to leave AA. And you got to learn how to leave AA in order to stay here. How do you leave AA? One judgment at a time. One compromised principle. One little more inundation of self, and one moving away from helping others and moving towards helping yourself. If I'm going to learn how to stay in the fellowship, I got to learn how to leave. And if I'm going to learn how to move towards God, I got to learn how to move away from me. It's a funny deal. And on page 62, it starts to talk about the root, really the root of my problem. And it says selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Now, it uses the word self a lot in this book. On the bottom of page 61, the first line, in the last paragraph, it equates ego and self when it says our actor is self-centered, egocentric. So ego-centered and self-centered, according to the book, they're equating them as being the same thing. So if selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of my troubles, that means that everything else comes from that. And that's going to prove to be true in the fourth step when we start looking for manifestations of self which had defeated us. Everything that is my problem is connected with self. Everything. The problem with self-righteousness, is self. The problem with self-justification is self. Is that I got the wrong driver. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. I had a hard time seeing that. And I have always considered myself bright. I had a high IQ. I don't know what, I must have.
You drank it up.
Drank it, drugged it and drank it up or something. Because sometimes I'm a knucklehead, man. I don't know how I could sit in meetings and listen to people talking about self-centeredness and sit there. And the honest thing, I remember this like yesterday. Sit there and think to myself, well, at least I'm glad I don't have a lot of problems, but I'm glad I don't have that one. I mean, geez, I'm not self-centered. I thought self-centered people were confident. I thought self-centered and self-confident were connected. I thought self-centered people thought they were better than everybody else, and I secretly felt like I was worse than everybody else. I had a wealth of shame within me, and so I don't think I'm self-centered. What I don't realize is that even though I think very poorly of myself, I do it constantly. I am centered on myself. And I was sitting in a meeting and some woman is sharing. Do you ever sit in a meeting where they go around the room to share? If you're ever in a meeting like that and you're like me, you're daydreaming, you're not really paying attention until it starts to get close to you, right? Then you start listening. And this woman is sharing and she used the term, she said she went through life totally self-absorbed. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking about what I'm going to say, what you're going to think about what I'm going to say, how I should sit while I'm saying it so I look like I know what I'm talking about. I'd been thinking prior to that about my job, my finances, my love life, my feelings, my past, my future. And when she said self-absorbed, like I got it, I'm totally absorbed in myself. I think underneath the obsession with alcohol, drugs, anything else, there's the granddaddy of all obsessions. Aren't I first and foremost obsessed with myself? My feelings, my security, my well-being, what you think of me. Me, me, me. I think the theme song of Alcoholics Anonymous should be I, me, 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 me. You know, it's just like, I don't know about you. I wake up in the morning. What's the first thing I think about? Me, pretty much. Just. I don't wake up wondering about you. Unless it has to do with me. If it has to do with me, I'm wondering about you a lot.
Wonder what you can do for me.
Yeah, what you can do for me. So selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Most of my life, when I wasn't drinking, I felt like I lived in a world that I was disconnected and apart from. Almost at times, sober in social gatherings where it would seem like there's some sort of invisible yet impenetrable barrier between me and life itself, something I could not surmount or break through. And everyone else on the other side of the window, the barrier, is all connected and a part of and intimate and having a wonderful time, and then there's me. And there was a time in my life where four shots of tequila and the barrier would go away, and I'd be free, and I'd feel like they look. And then as alcoholism progressed and I lost the ability to do that, the book says we know a loneliness such as few do because I can't get out of the box no more. Alcohol in the later years had stopped relieving me of the bondage of self. And alcohol was a very spiritual tool at one time. And you know, the word alcohol is referred to as spirits. And the word spirit comes from the Latin. It means the breath of life, which is when you take your first drink after days of absence. You ever go have that feeling of the breath of life? And somehow, in the early days when the hook was set, alcohol relieved me of this self-obsession. It freed me. And we all remember those times when a guy like me who doesn't really care about anybody, who doesn't fit, cannot connect, and I can't even listen to other people. After five drinks, man, I just love everybody. After about five drinks, man, I'm there for you, man. I'm there for you. Really and truly, I can hear you. I'm right here now. And then I'd sober up and I'm back in the jail cell again. Right? I'm back being a prisoner, locked up in me. So if you're this is the root of our troubles, and then it says we're driven, and oh man, I felt driven most of my life. Driven by 100 forms of fear. Well, I don't know if there's 100, but there's a lot. Remorse is fear. It's fear of retribution, fear of what you think of me, fear of being found out, fear of being caught, guilt's fear, apprehension's fear, anxiety is fear, worry is fear. It's funny how I discount all that stuff. Oh, I'm not afraid. Anger is always based on fear. That's one of the great things out of the resentment inventory is I find that every resentment came because something was threatened. Something was hurt or threatened. So I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, that psychotic wishful thinking. Life's not really like this, but I want it to be a certain way so bad I imagine that it is. And who's the crazy person interacting with people when I expect you to be something you never said you were, and then when you're not, I'm pissed? Who's the crazy person in that equation? Self-seeking. Isn't it first and foremost all about me getting what I need? And self-pity. Self-pity is the most hideous aspect of self. I hate self-pity. I liked the word depression. Depression. Now, depression, you can go to your friends and they say, Bob, what's wrong? I have deep depression. Oh, real? Let me buy you a drink. If you go to your friends, what's wrong, Bob? I'm feeling sorry for myself. It's such an unmanly emotion. Self-pity. It's pathetic, isn't it? I tell you, the first time I caught myself being driven by self-pity, I was early sobriety. There was a guy in my home group who was having a big party up on the hill. Open house party. There were flyers out. Sitting in my home group, I watched him walk across the room and personally invite somebody. Now, he never did that for me. So Sunday morning of the party, one of my friends calls me up and says, are you going up to so-and-so's house for the party? No, I'm not going to go. Why not? Well, I just don't feel like they really want me up there. What are you talking about? It's your home group. It's an open house. You're going... No, that's all right. You go ahead. Don't worry about me. I'm going to watch some reruns of Gilligan's Island. Isn't that pathetic? Isn't that just, it's squirmy. It's awful. And yet, how often would I sit, even drunk or sober, sit with a bottle of vodka and I cry? I had an Alaskan Malamute before I couldn't take care of it anymore. My parents eventually took it off my hands because I couldn't even feed it because I couldn't. That was on the streets. But this dog was so fun. I'd get a bottle of wine, and the dog just loved me. And I'd sit there with my arm around the dog, and I'd drink wine, and I'd start talking about how I've been mistreated, and I'd start crying, and the dog would start howling, and I'd be crying, and the dog's howling. Oh, it was just it was a pity fest. It was wonderful. I kind of get warm and mushy just thinking about it now. Self-pity, driven by all of these things, fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity, I step on the toes of everybody around me. And what happens? What happens when somebody steps on your toes? Eventually, you might turn the other cheek once or twice. Eventually, you're going to retaliate. Eventually, other people just get it up to here with us. And then they start firing on us. The problem is, I don't know what I've done. I can't see past myself. Alcoholics live in a paradigm of self-destruction, and we don't even get it. We don't even get it. We feel like victims. We don't know why people are turning on us, and it tells us here exactly why. says sometimes they hurt us, seemingly without provocation, seemingly to me like without any reason. Why, for God's sakes, after all I've done for them, are they doing this to me? But, and this is a vision of what I'll find in step four, but I will invariably, which means almost always, I will invariably find that at some time in the past, I've made decisions based on self, on me, and my security, and my gratification, and what I want, and protecting what I have, and what you think of me. I made decisions based on me, which later placed me in that position to be hurt. The book says, so our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. I tell the guys I sponsor this, and it's really true. I said, if you do the fourth step as it's outlined in the big book, and Scott and I are going to spend a lot of time on this, not only will it change you, but you will go to meetings for the rest of your life, and you will know after 5 minutes of listening to a guy whether he's ever done it or not. Because the people that do it are never the same. And a lot of things change, but one of the basic things that's never the same is you're never able to sell yourself the bill of goods on any occasion that you're a victim. You can't. You know the truth. You know, I'm the guy who put the target on my head. I'm the guy who put the kick me sign on me, right? I'm the guy who did the impersonation of someone who needs to be hurt long enough until somebody hurt me. I'm the guy, right? Scott, you want to go through
them? Yeah. I was reminded, a friend of mine said, and I thought it was true in my case, and he said, there are only two things the alcoholic does not like: the way things are and change. And I think this process that we're in is to try to get me into a different mindset. I love the way Bob covers this stuff. And I thank you all again for the chance to come sit here next to him and do this. I get so much out of it. At this point on page 62, my sponsor said to me, how would you like some good news? I said, man, I could go for some good news. He said, I'm not talking about good. He said, how would you like to hear the most fantastic, the very best news you're ever going to hear in your entire life? I said, I'm on for that, Jerry. What is it? He said, it's right here. I said, all right, hit me with it. He says, so our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. Was that it, Jerry? Yeah, that was it. I don't get it. He said, that's the best news you're ever going to get. Because if it really is, the cops, the courts, the judges, the wife, the Chinese, the Russians, and the PTA, and the neighbors, and the in-laws, if it really is them, you are cooked. Because we can't do a thing about them. The good news is that you are the problem. And if you'll bring a little willingness to this party, we can work on that. I think he was right. I think it's the best news I ever got. I am the problem. Wow. Rise out of ourselves. The alcoholic's an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he doesn't usually think so. Above everything. I wonder if that's important. Above everything. That's somewhere right along in the middle, right? Above everything. We alcoholics must. There are no musts. Here's another one. We alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. Above everything. And then here's a simple reason. We must, or it kills us. Oh, well. That's not very subtle. And it says God makes that possible. And I was offended by that for a while. And I understand it on a different level now. I'll share it just in case you can use it. I believe, this is just red flags, it's just my experience. I was given as part of the gift of this life in this body, the gift of self-will. And that God will intervene in a life like mine. A guy like an Air Force pilot with 2,000 hours of flying time, some of it drunk, most of it very hungover, doesn't live. Right? We bury those. Plus all that other stuff I was doing. So he does intervene in some ways. But there's a limit somehow, and I don't know where it is, but I believe there's a limit. But when I pray this third step prayer, when I give the carte blanche, when I say, take me, I think it opens up. That I offer that self-will back to him as a gift, it opens up his coming in to make changes in my life. And I can't explain that. I don't want to defend it. But that is my experience with it. That's part of what this is about, is I had to just enjoy all I could stand of my own self-will Because a guy like me, a hard-headed guy like me, ain't going to get it any other way. And at that point, then I'm willing for it to be his way, fully willing. I'm signing it. I don't have any questions. I'm signing it. That's what this is about. And I believe that he will honor that self-will all the way to death, because I see it happen. I see nice people like us die of this disease, who had this presented to him. And I don't believe that we were chosen and he wasn't. I believe that I got to a point where I was willing to have it God's way, and I don't care what that means anymore. I can't stand any more of mine. And that was the piece that opened the door for me. There often seems no way of getting entirely rid of self without his aid. This concept is so important that we're going to tell me twice in this paragraph that self doesn't have the power to push self out of the center. I'm going to talk about that when we get to step 6 and 7, a beautiful lesson I got from a sponsor. I had moral philosophical convictions galore, but I couldn't live up to them. Neither could I reduce my self-centeredness by wishing or trying on my own power. I had to have God's help. So there it is, twice. I got to have God's help for this thing. This is the how and the why, but first of all, we had to quit playing God. I trapped one of my teachers in a hotel lobby for 3 hours one morning, literally, and I was firing questions at him and making notes, and I learned so much that morning. At one point, I think he became tired, and he said, "Let me ask you a question." I thought, all right, here, I'm going to get a chance to impress him. And he said, on page 62, you agreed to quit playing God. I said, yes. He said, how'd you play God? I said, I don't know. And he said, here's how I played God. I became angry when someone died. And that's me saying, I know who should die and how and when. And clearly that is playing God. I tried to manage my own life and the lives around me. And the closer someone was to me, the harder I tried to manage their life. Playing God. I judged people. And the reason I know that is because I had resentment. The word resent comes from the Latin. Re means again, like reread. It's something you do another time. And sentire means to feel. So resent means to feel again. And to get a resentment, I must first judge someone, find them guilty, be angry with them, and then feel that anger again. So that's by definition, resent means to feel again old anger. And if I've got resentment, I had to start by judging. It's the only way to get one. Those were his. I have added some of my own. One is that I trusted my motive. When I'm operating from motive, I'm playing God, very simply. I know how it should turn out. See, I'm not on the results committee anymore. I can't be if I'm not going to be in management. So I trusted my motive. Another was that I needed to know. I asked the question, why? Whenever I'm asking why, I'm playing God. That's how it is for me. I'm not trying to sell this to you. That's how it is for me. Because I ask you why, I'm saying if St. Scott can get enough pieces here, he will paste all this together, and it will now work. Yeah, and my spiritual arrogance knows no bounds. It really doesn't. Another one was that I was certain that everything that I knew was correct, and if you disagreed with me, you were clearly a fool. And that is playing God, and it, by the way, completely blocks the learning process. And the one I just recently discovered was that I lied. I didn't recently discover that I lied. I have actually suspected it for some time. Let me present that another way for you.
I think you just lied.
It's my turn. What I mean was I just realized that lying was one of the ways I played God. Because when I lie, what I'm doing is I'm making the result come out the way I think it should come out. And I get outside of principle by doing that. So when I lie, I'm actually playing God because I'm governing the result. That was big stuff for me. First of all, we had to quit playing God. So I asked him, are you willing? These are some of the ways I did. Are you willing? Next, we decided here after this drama of life, God was going to be our director. He's the principal, we're his agency, he's the father, we're his children. This is the decision referred to in the short form of the step. Are you prepared to make this decision? And if you need some time, I want you to take it. We're not messing around here. This is not light duty stuff. These aren't just words. You want some time? Take it. Generally, they say, I'm ready. Say, fine. Give that back to me in the first person singular, and he will say, I have decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God is going to be my director. He is the principal. I am his agent. He is the father. I am his child. And I will say, I believe you have made an excellent decision. I want to make a pact with you. And the pact is that that decision will stand in your life until such time as you go completely insane and decide to change it. And if that day ever comes, that you will formally change it as you have formally made it with me or with one of my successors. Do we have a deal? We do. We shake on it. If I bring him through the steps another time, I do not call for a decision at step 3. and say, you have a good decision in place. Do we need to talk about it? And then let's leave it. I don't need to keep making this decision. I love what Bob says, that there's a yes in every barrel of no's. I don't want the lid off the barrel. And I love the metaphors, the masonry metaphors. Most good ideas are simple. As concepts as the keystone. I wonder if that's important, the keystone. The keystone's the thing that makes the arch work. It's shaped differently from all the others. It's right there in the middle, and it's the thing that makes it work. Keystone. Above everything. New and triumphant arts through which we pass to freedom. And then we have the third step promises. I'm sure you're familiar with them, and because of time constraints, I'm not going to read them all, but I want to make a point about four or five lines down. It says, established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. Above everything, we must be rid of this selfishness. So what's happened between above everything and the beginning of this thing I must have, which it just described? And what's happened is I have made the decision that I'm going to quit playing God with his help, because I'm going to need it. That's what it told me twice. And that I have decided that he's in charge and that suits me. And those pieces put together are the beginning of the abandonment of selfishness. And I'm not batting 1,000 on it, but I can report tremendous progress. And I think that's an important, progress is an important thing. And I'm going to give you my own definition. Progress is making the same old mistake a little less often, or making a new and finer quality of mistake. That's progress. Because anything above that would be perfection. Okay? And then the prayer. And what I like to do is I want him to read the prayer and let's talk about what it means. Let's understand what you're saying here. God, offer myself to you. Not give me some help. Not make sure the judge doesn't. Not send her back. Not get me out of this and I'll never do it again. Take me. I offer myself to thee. To build with me. A lot of times to build somewhere, we're going to have to tear down something that's already standing there. I think we do newcomers a great disservice by not telling them that. Don't mess around with this prayer. You pray this thing, I'll tell you something. Probably some things you'd like to keep are leaving, and they are not coming back. And some things you don't like are coming and staying. All right? This is a package deal. All right? I think about two bowling balls. My will, God's will, pick one. I had my will 41 years, killing me, devastating everybody around me. I was always afraid I'd work God too hard. I'll tell you what, I'm going to cover sex and money. He can get the rest. That's not the package. That's not the package. Two bowling balls, pick one. God's will, my will, pick one. That's what we're asking you here. All right? Because there are going to be some parts you don't like. Overall, it's a spectacular package. But I don't want what I want anymore. It was killing me. To build with me and do as me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self. I looked up bondage. It means the exact same thing as slavery. I'm a slave to self. That I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties. One reason. Victor over them may bear witness to those I would help. Of thy power, thy love, thy way of life. May I do thy will always. I note that the word amen does not appear here. The only place I can find it in the basic text is at the end of the seven-step prayer. And I have friends that say they believe that everything from the beginning of that prayer to the end of the seventh-step prayer is a prayer. I don't know. It's an interesting observation. And then it says, we thought well. You want some time? Think about this a couple of days. I know guys that require that they think about it a couple of days. I don't do that. I don't think it's a bad idea. Think about it. Are you really serious? And the next paragraph, it suggests that we want to do this with someone. Maybe the wife, friend, spiritual advisor. The guys I sponsor are free to do their third step prayer with anybody they want to. And me. I'm going to be there. I think it's so important for sponsorship to be tight. I have had the experience. I have, Bob and I both, by the way, I speak for both of us. We have permission to tell all the stories you hear us tell. I have had the experience of having a guy do a third step prayer who was unable to come up off his knees in tears. Someone who has done this needs to be there when that happens. Someone needs to be there who knows what to do there. And then it suggests that you can write your own third step prayer. And I invite them to do that. Book says you can do that. Book gives leeway. I give leeway. And I sponsor some songwriters. They won't give you a five-year chip in Nashville if you don't sponsor at least two songwriters. We can't give you one because there are just so many. And someone's got to cover them, and I got a couple. And the newest one's got 2 years now. And we got here, and he said, I want to write my own third-step prayer. I said, great, go for it. But I'm going to read that prayer before we do the praying part. And it was a beautiful thing. I wouldn't be surprised if you guys heard this on the radio sometime. It rhymed. It was magnificent, three stanzas. But it left out the part about God being in charge, and that was okay with him, which I think is relatively significant here in this particular prayer. And strangely enough, we wound up using the one in the book. But I've seen some great stuff. The most frequent change I see is they change thee and thou to, or thy and thou to you kind of thing. And that's fine. People are uncomfortable with the old English. But most of them say, you know, everything I touch, let's do what it says there. Suits me just fine. But and then, of course, the last thing that you do is to actually pray the prayer. And that completes that step. Forgive me, because this is just how I am. It looks to me like this step breaks down into eight or nine pieces. The first one was at the bottom of page 60. The first requirement is that I be convinced. Then there's some very interesting observations on motive and self and all of that stuff. And then the second one is that I had to quit playing God. The third one is this decision. For me, the fourth one is to read and understand the prayer. The fifth one is to think well. The sixth one is to slow down. I'm from the South. I'm not too slow for y'all now. You want me to start that again? I don't mean to go that fast. And y'all, please do that to me. I get very excited. Huh? Read and understand the prayer, and then think well, and then decide who is going to witness your third step prayer, and select a time and a place, and then to decide if you're going to write one of your own. If you do, to write it. If not, then you acknowledge that you're going to use one in the book. And the last piece is to pray the prayer. And I find that breaking it down those little bitty pieces just really makes it quite easy. And we are going to do that with step four. I have such a passion. I believe step four is the easiest step we have. Far and away the easiest. A little bit on the long side. But I'm talking, to be sincere with you, I'm talking about the actual four-step cleverly concealed in this book. When I got out of treatment, they gave me one of these psychobabble things. And, I mean, God bless them. I think there's some wonderful people with big hearts really trying to help people by taking the short form of the steps and writing around them. And they had all of this stuff. I have to go very slow, or I'm going to have to make amends for my language about what I really think about that stuff. But I think they have good motive. But I think they violate principle, which gets me in trouble. But this thing, I mean, was true, false, multiple choice, fill in the blanks. Do you still hate your mother is one of the questions. I mean, come on. And what happened for me was that I completed this thing. I called back down to the treatment center I'd gone through to Bernie. Now, Bernie had not been my counselor, but I had selected him after I had my white light experience to hear my fifth step. He was a counselor, but he wasn't mine. But I asked him because I knew I was going to have to do a full confession, which is what step five is. And the reason I chose him is you could look at him and tell he was stoned out of his mind. But you know what that looks like. A guy's face is real relaxed. He got this dumb grin. When he walks, he moves real slow, kind of shuffles like, this guy's ripped. I am going to do my fifth step with him. Right? 2 weeks later, is he going to know what I said? He won't know if I did it. So I thought, right? Makes good sense. So I completed this psychobabble four-step thingy, this alleged four-step. And I called Bernie. He said, sure, I drove. That's about 4 hours. I drove down. I took my fifth step with Bernie, which is where I began to get relief. If you're new, I know they don't look like it. But what the steps do is they bring me relief. They they put salve on the wounds in my soul and allow them to start to heal. Some of them have got to have the scabs picked, and that's part of what we're going to talk about. But it's a tremendous cleansing process. And I dumped my bucket with Bernie. I told him the whole thing, all of it. And it was the beginning of the new freedom for me. It's where I began to get relief. I know it doesn't look that way if you're new, but that's what it does. And just as an aside, Bernie wasn't stoned. Bernie was sober over 20 years. That was serenity. I didn't know what it looked like because I knew, you know. I want you to know that as I do this kind of stuff, that I think that content is far more important than format. Far, far more important. I think there are a lot of really right ways to do what we're going to talk about here with a sponsor working out of this book. And I'll talk about several of the others that other people do as we do this. This is just what I've been shown. This is what my lineage passed to me. But we work out of this text, and it changes life. This, you got something else on three? Go ahead. Yeah, that's about what we got.
Thanks, Scott. One of the things that I had to get clear on was that step three is not about turning my will and my life over to the care of God. Step three is about approaching a process to do that. The rest of the 12 steps is what allows me to. Step three is simply the turning point. It's the rest of the steps that allows the turn. One of the things that I did, and there may be people in this room that are stuck, like I was stuck. In my early sobriety, I got down on my knees. I did exactly what Scott was talking about. I ended up doing the third step prayer. I was sincere about the desire to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. And then I started to destroy myself unconsciously. And I didn't know what was going on. And what was happening is every morning I would get down on my knees and I would say the third step prayer. I'd get up off my knees. 5 minutes later, I'm in my head running the universe. And what had happened is I had tried to give God my life, but unbeknownst to me, because not out of malice but out of ignorance, I've retained my will because I'm blocked from surrendering it. And because I don't even know what my will is. years ago, I went to an attorney to make a will. I ended up with a lot of properties and things, and I needed to make a will, a trust. And this guy said something to me that caught my attention. He said, "You know what your last will is?" I said, "Well, you're making this a legal document." He said, it's really your last judgment. You're judging these people to be idiots. They don't get nothing. You're judging them to be cool. They're going to get something. And the problem that I faced is that I'm trying to give God my life, but I've retained my judgment of it. My judgment about me, what's good and bad. My judgment about you, what's good and bad. My judgment about life itself, what's good and bad. And so consequently, I exist in a state of frantic running the show within me. And the conflicts there, I suffer from depression, lots of anxiety. I build cases against people. I go through one job after another, and I don't know what the problem is. I didn't get any relief until I dismantled the judgment machine that is my will in step four. I think that's what it's designed to do. It's designed to break down the ego. When you go through your whole life, because what's your resentment list? All your judgments. Your fears are really your judgments and your view of life and the things you think are going to happen or afraid are going to happen or whatever. And all the self-gratification stuff in the sex deal. And you look at that and you see how wrong you had been about everything. About everything. And you realize not only was I wrong judging those people, I was wrong. I've been wrong about me. I'm wrong about you. I'm wrong about everything. And the ego gets squashed. I revisited a lot of the religion of my childhood. What I discovered is if you work the steps and you have an awakening, all of a sudden, all of them make sense. Where none of them made sense before, now they all kind of make sense. And I started looking at the story, the biblical story out of Genesis of creation. And it talks about Adam and Eve, and God created them, and he put them in to the Garden of Eden, which was literally heaven on earth. It was referred to as paradise. And in the Garden of Eden, they were happy. They had everything they ever could need. It was perfect. They were given one suggestion. And the suggestion was, do whatever you want, but don't eat the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And I think kind of because they were suggested they shouldn't, sort of like when your sponsor says, don't get involved with that person. You didn't want to till he said that. You know what I mean? Oh, geez. And they ate the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And I think that's exactly what they got. They got the judgment. And what had been perfect in paradise in their innocence all of a sudden became tainted because the ego is what judges. And all of a sudden, Adam's going, God, there's crabgrass, there's flies. Eve's got cellulite. What are you thinking here? And what had been heaven became tainted, and nothing changed, except that the ego started playing God again. One of my mentors, Chuck Chamberlain, told a story that really affected me. He said he was a couple days dry off of a bad drunk, and he was sitting in this chair in his house, and he was sitting in this house, married to that woman with those kids, working at that place, and he wished he was dead. He felt like he was in hell. Years later, as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps and a spiritual awakening, he sat in the same chair in the same house, married to the same woman with the same kids, working in the same place, and he's crying because he knew he was in heaven. And he said, maybe heaven's just a new pair of glasses. What am I surrendering is everything I think I know. I'm surrendering all my judgments. I'm surrendering everything I think I'm right about. Me, you, God, life itself. Scott?
When I was new, I used to say absolutely insane things. One of them was I was constantly either saying I'm having a good day or I'm having a bad day. Is that not crazy? I mean, when I say I'm having a good day, what am I really saying? Scott's will is being done today. When I say I'm having a bad day, I'm saying Scott's will is not being done today. And Scott's will is one of the biggest problems I got, or there are many mistakes in this book. It's one or the other. I got to get out of that. If you had asked me my first day sober what kind of day I was having, it would have taken me 45 minutes to tell you. The air would have been blue for a mile downwind from there by the time I got through. And I can't look back today and say that was a bad day. I don't know. I can tell you I'm enjoying it or I'm not. But I don't know if it's a good day or a bad day. How would I know? I'm not in management anymore. Tremendous, tremendous stuff. Resentment is when I didn't get my will in the past. Anger and depression are when I'm not getting my will right now. And fear is the concern that I may not get my will in the future. And it always comes back to my will, always. My sponsor told me step four, that all that garbage in my past is not who I am. That's who I'm not. Because if that's who I am, I'm still out there doing it. It doesn't make me sick to think about it. What I would be taught here was how to quit doing who I'm not. How to repair the damage for doing who I'm not. How to receive the forgiveness for doing who I am not. And who I really am would emerge from the ashes like the phoenix. That's what step four was about. It was about digging poison out of my soul. Because the fact that here's a gift from my home group. I remember when the guy said this. God forgives me for everything I ever did, and he loved me while I was doing it. My God got bigger that day. And this other piece I'll tell you before the break is that I don't have the power to make a mistake so ugly that God can't turn it into something magnificent. I didn't say fix. Lack of power is my dilemma. I do not have the power to make the mistake so ugly that he can't turn it into something magnificent. That's who I am. That's who he is. That's what we're going to talk about in 16 minutes and 3 seconds. We will be starting on time. If you're compulsive.